All right, ready? Here we go.
Did it.
I don't want a pickle. I just want to ride on my motorcycle.
Okay, we're at Noco Moto episode 19. I'm your host, MotoGP. With me is Swiggy.
Yep.
And with us once again is Dr. Mike Action.
Hey.
I think we should clarify, this is episode 19, part 2.
Yeah. Or take two. Take two. My bad. We recorded yesterday, and then speeding away from the podcast on my bike, I had the pocket of my backpack open, in which was a Masterlink I'd been waiting on in the mail, my SD to USB adapter for the laptop, and the SD card containing all of the audio for this episode. And a pack of smokes and other things, some battery packs. I lost a lot of stuff. And I'm not real proud of it, you know, but, you know, it takes a big man to admit when he's wrong. Right. So moving on from that. Okay. We're not in NoCo for once. We're actually in, what is this section? We're in Castle Rock, but what is this part of the state called?
Or this Douglas County? It's just the Front Range. I don't know if the areas of the Front Range have different, I don't know.
Is this not qualify as Northern Colorado?
We're south of Denver. We're just south of Denver.
I feel like I think you're safe until you hit Colorado Springs.
All right. So the Palmer Divide then.
Yeah.
Okay. So you hit Monument, you got a little ways to go yet. But if you hit Palmer Lake, all bets are off.
Okay. So, that was boring. But anyway, moving on. We got anything interesting to talk about, like revisiting all this subject material again to start with?
I do have something to talk about, but I'm going to wait until after we do best bike, worst bike.
Okay.
Because it's a little bit of a spoiler.
Okay. So, anticlimactically, since I already know what it is, I guess Swiggy's going to tell us what the best bike in the world is. Okay. But, you know, since our listeners don't know, reveal it.
The Triumph Street Triple RS.
Badass. I love this motorcycle. I love everything about it.
So, okay, if you need a good reason just to objectively understand why this bike is so great, it's got a 75 out of 100 on bikes.com.
The optimal number.
And as you know, every bike on bikes.com is between 46 and 54. Every single bike.
In my experience, all the best ones are between like 63 and 78, but yeah.
But it's definitely graded on a curve, and that's an outstanding score.
It's true. The highest I've seen is 80. Like, I've not seen anything break 80. Mm-hmm. But also, I have no idea where they're getting that data. Like, what that number is based on, who's voting. It's a complete mystery.
It's true.
There is less mystery about how the Federal Reserve works than how bikes.com figures their ratings.
That's probably objectively true.
So.
Okay. So some stats on this bike. It's a 765cc inline 3, 123 horsepower, red lines around 12,000 RPM, 57 foot-pounds of torque in a package that weighs about 410 pounds wet.
Right, which is all awesome. Is any of it class-leading? No, but just all around, badass.
Super badass. But the other thing about this bike is it's really, really hard to find anyone who has anything negative to say about this bike. And it's pretty much brought on the resurgence of the Naked Street Fighter.
Well, it almost in a production sense, it is the beginning, middle, and final word and be all and end all of production Street Fighters. I mean, besides this and the Ducati Street Fighter, how many like production Street Fighter styled bikes are there really?
It's a little bit of a reach, but you could there's like the Z900, which is full on Street Fighter. You could make a case for, you know, the CB650F or for the SV650. They're not really full on Street Fighters.
Yeah.
Which is I'm kind of ashamed I actually said that.
Yeah, like, what is a real... How authentic is your Street Fighter, Swiggy? I mean, you know, did you crash it in 1993? Is it really a Street Fighter? Did you crash it in Birmingham in the late 90s or what? Like,
I feel like one of the requirements is you have to crash it without insurance.
Yeah, you know, well, Mike, so like when we were talking about this yesterday, you weren't really familiar with the breakdown of like Street Fighters, what makes a Street Fighter, the history of a Street Fighter. So we should go through that again, since there may be a lot of people that legitimately don't really know the Street Fighter thing.
I thought it was an enthralling story. I'd love to hear it again.
So I really can't tell if you're fucking with me or not. So basically the idea is, Birmingham, you know, in the 60s and 70s, the height of the cafe thing was the center of sport bikes. BSA, Norton, Triumph, all that stuff right there. It's always been an area where predominantly everyone rides sport bikes. That culture has never really died. And so in the 90s, you get all these guys, you know, that fancy themselves road racers and everything, and they're all riding their super sport bikes around that area, and they're racing each other on public roads, and they would crash them like crazy, but they weren't going to not ride, so they all just did whatever they could do to cheaply and quickly get their bikes road legal and back on the road again, and just in the... I don't know, what do you call that? The mechanics, the whatever. This aesthetic naturally evolved out of what these guys were doing. So they would just rip off all the plastic, say, to hell with it. Sometimes put some crash bars on the outside, sort of a bit of a stunter thing, but not really all that much. But essentially strip the bike down and basically just grab whatever headlights they could and whatever bracketry to just make it work.
And handlebars. Whatever aftermarket handlebars they could put on the bike.
Usually, yeah, just total straight bars mounted in some crazy way. They would swap out they would completely trash the front end of these bikes. So it would work out that they would end up replacing the triple tree and the forks and all that with just whatever worked. And they would quite often just replace it with a triple tree, whatever, that you could just mount whatever bars to rather than going with clip-ons or whatever else. So it sort of ended up having these sort of, you know, scrambler bars quite often, or just regular or whatever kind of bars, but straight bars predominantly. But sometimes putting clip-ons back on. But the Triumph Street Triple, in this weird way, is the most sort of legit bike that Triumph makes, because it made an attempt to play on sort of the new or more recent history of the area and bikes by essentially just creating a Street Fighter out of the box, which to my knowledge, no one had ever done before.
As far as I know. Yeah.
And Ducati makes that Street Fighter, but that's the only other one that I know of.
Well, Ducati didn't even come out with their... Oh, when did they come out with it? I want to say
wasn't the Street Fighter a version of the 999? It's pre-Panigale.
I think the 696 was the first one.
Could have been.
And then at some point they released the Street Fighter 1200. Possibly the biggest misstep in Ducati history.
Yeah, definitely did not hit the awesome styling points that the Monster did. Yeah, not a fan right here, but whatever. So we've got, anyway, this bike is, you would think, a big departure from what Triumph has done in that, you know, they've brought back all these iconic names from the past, the Bonneville, the Rocket 3, the Tiger, all this stuff. Then here comes, you know, the Daytona and the Street Triple, which seem to be really at odds with them playing up the classic name of the company. But in a way, these are really sort of the most genuine bikes that they do in philosophy.
It's also kind of this really iconic thing around Birmingham in a sort of somewhat trashy but more prestigious way than, say, the story of golf carts in Franklin, Indiana.
Oh, God. You mean how, like, so many people were getting DUIs that having a DUI scooter wasn't enough and everyone had to start arms race, like, one-upping with custom golf carts?
Yeah.
Oh, so disgusting. So sad. And such a true story. Well, the whole, like, Franklin, Greenwood, Edinburgh area was really just plagued by these custom golf cart shops that were just popping up because State Patrol really had nothing better to do than harass rednecks on like three beers leaving the bar for quite a while. Yeah, South Central Indiana was just kind of out of problems for a while, so they just really needed to harass white trash because there was like no one else left to harass anymore.
Well, I mean, but it's also kind of that thing, you know, the whole kind of prestigious arms race, but built of this kind of necessity. It's a weird comparison, but
yes, it is.
But, you know, it was one of those things where, okay, you crash your bike, you can just rip the fairings off and call it a day. But once you do that, oh, well, your coolant reservoir and your fuse box and all these other little things and all the routing on your wiring, it was all designed around being hidden under a fairing. So it didn't make a lot of sense. Like, you couldn't just rip the fairings off and ride it around. It would be just a total disaster.
Yes.
But everyone came up with, you know, how can I reroute these wires through the frame so it's all tucked away and hidden? And really, you just have the motor on display the same way you'd have on an old CB750. And kind of refining this sort of minimalistic aesthetic, not because they were going for a minimalist aesthetic, but out of necessity to make it work with what they had.
Yeah. So, I don't, and getting back to this bike, you know, anyone that's ever ridden a Triumph Triple raves and raves and raves about it. I've never ridden one, which saddens me, and I need to make an excuse to do it soon. But from what I gather is, you know, for the weight of it, it's got really great torque. It's got really great power. It's got, you know, all these things that you want, but it's this great middle balance where it scratches a lot of itches in terms of a sport bike, right? It's got more torque than the 600 and different engine characteristics. So if you're not in an all-out racing class, right, and you don't care that eventually the 600 will pass you, right, this thing kind of has a few more, I don't know, it's a little bit more exciting because it's beefed up in the torque and the sound's different. The vibration is different and all of that. So when you're in that medium sport bike category, this is ultimately way more satisfying than your usual 600 experience.
Oh, absolutely. It's one of those things where, you know, I would rather have 90 horsepower and 70 foot-pounds of torque than 120 horsepower and 40 foot-pounds of torque. Right. Because you will always be able to max out that torque on the more powerful motorcycle. But in the real world, how often are you going to use 120 horsepower?
Not often.
Extremely rarely. It's just not as practical in the real world. And you don't get to stretch those muscles.
Yeah, going back to the styling, I mentioned this the first round. What was the first year that they did the Triumph triple here? Because if you look up a picture of the street triple the first year, let's Google it here. First year. It's definitely a different looking bike. And it's got the round headlights and all of that. And then if you put it side by side with a new street triple, you know, the bike has definitely changed when you put it side by side. But when you look at the photos individually, it's still just a street triple. And I said, you know, this bike has survived a styling change that I think is a lot like the way AC/DC switched singers and no one made a big fuss about it. Everyone just sort of went with it and went, yeah, that's just, you know, that's AC/DC still cool. And that's a really hard trick to pull off. I can't think of another bike that's gone through some changes like, you know, like what kind of bike has gone through a headlight change like this when, you know, the only feature up front is like the headlight, you know, when the headlights are, this would be like a Jeep Wrangler changing the grill and no one noticing. Right. So this is a really hard feat to pull off, you know, and it's not just the headlights, the tank changed, the frame changed, the tail changed, everything changed, but quietly, like no one notices that much or cares that much because in overall essence, the bike still says all the exact same things and gets its message across and what it's trying to be and what it's trying to say and what it's trying to do. And as we always say, you know, we like bikes that are really, really honest about what they are. We don't want them to lie. We want them to kind of be true to what they are and their message. And it's hard to be more honest about what a bike is than this bike. It's going, hey, yeah, it's a stripped down Daytona. Like, check it out. I've got weird headlights. Like, I'm the Street Fighter Daytona. End of story.
Pretty much. I mean, I would say this bike has changed more in 10 years than the CB750 did in 25.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's changed, yeah, just as much as the Daytona changed in that time as well. It's changed a hell of a lot more than any Harley model ever did in that amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Let's think. I mean, you know, a Yamaha's triples have hardly changed. I mean, they changed displacements, but, you know, the overall look of those hasn't radically shifted.
I mean, they've made different models, but, you know, you still have the, like the MT-09 is still kind of the same bike it's always been.
Yeah, the largest change on that was the name from FZ to MT.
Also, this Which, bike
for a second, is... I want to say, how is MT something better to call something than FZ? FZ just sounds fucking fast and cool.
It does.
MT? What does MT mean? MT sounds like, I don't know, like a designate MT-09 sounds like a really small pistol.
It sounds like a designation for like a consumer sized excavator. Like it doesn't I don't know. It's weird. Well, I will say,
stand for, do you think?
I don't know. More torque. And I don't care to look it up.
Yeah, I don't care either. I mean, but it's been called the MT in Europe this whole time.
Yeah, the problem is that worldwide it's called the MT, and for some reason they switched it to the FC for America, which happened to be way better. But because MT has the name consensus, the name recognition worldwide, and they're trying to properly switch it to a world model in terms of its branding, they finally said, okay, well, we'll just call it the MT in America as well. Hmm. Which is what, instead, they should have just said, well, the FZ sounds way cooler.
Yeah, change the MT to the FZ. Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah. FZ, first off, is like almost written in italics anyway, the way it's kind of angled. You know, it just looks italics.
Yeah, it's badass.
It's on a slant.
Yeah, well, everyone knows Z is a letter that, if it's in the name of any car or bike, means fast.
Or video and game. And
F quite often means it's fucking fast. Like, I guess in Honda, F means it's a little less fast. But outside of that, F is usually like a good sign in any automobile, like alphanumeric designation, right? F, Z, and R, right? Of course, you know, culminating in the greatest ever, the Yamaha FZR, right? But that's why it's just the FZ, because it's not the FZR. These are the naked bike series, right? So instead of like Honda adding on an F, Yamaha just dropped the R. But yeah, yeah.
In any case,
MT is a name that sucks, but the Street Triple is a badass name.
Right. And it's also you know, it's already got that character as well, which, I mean, how many, besides, you know, the H2 back in 71, is there really any triple that's become like wildly popular?
No. I mean, you know, Yamaha had that XS750 triple. But that didn't catch on, and it was a four-stroke triple, and that was kind of cool back at the time, but not a real big mover, not like this is.
Right, and you know, we talk about how, you know, the Daytona was this bike that kind of really brought Triumph back.
Yes.
And this bike took the formula and transformed it into the current model appeal. And it's questionable whether this bike started that appeal or whether it just fit in perfectly. But this really is kind of, this is the style and the fashion of our time, of this current age of motorcycles. This is the young, what's the word? This is kind of the current vision of motorcycles.
You know what this bike is? This bike is absolutely the poster child for an entire engine configuration, right? There is no motorcycle, single motorcycle, that is the face of inline fours. There's no motorcycle that is, you know, the fan favorite of all, you know, parallel twins. There's no absolute king of the V-twins, right? But you could definitely say without a doubt that the Triumph Street Triple is the best-selling and most popular triple, and it really defines the entire category.
Perhaps that's why next year Moto 2 will switch to a 765cc triple from Triumph.
Yes.
Shocker.
Super badass. I'm so excited for that. Like, I can't wait to hear the sound of those bikes live. I can't wait for that. It's going to be unreal, right? Because these bikes sound awesome anyway. I can't imagine what the full-on race spec version does.
It's full-on race spec with an unrestricted exhaust running super rich and backfiring like crazy under engine braking. Just take the most ridiculous hooligan bike with a stupid non-street legal slip on that you've heard going down the street and multiply it by 100. That's basically what the track bikes sound like.
It's going to sound like Mike's Firebolt with like a stutter. I think it's gonna sound big and like male violent. Well, you know, there's this sort of like, as loud and brash as the GP bikes are, there is this sort of like elegance to their sound as they come by, right? Mm-hmm. And when you're there live and you really do hear the big like after fires when they're under braking and everything, there is
a sort of beauty to the after fire when it happens on every single power stroke.
Yeah. There's something to it that is a little bit, you know, and the bike's moving smooth and clean and whatever, but you know, there's some sort of, you know, there's something very impressive and brutish. You know, anyone that's like ridden at night behind a Buell knows what it's like to have these like fireballs spit at you, right? And the bike just sort of like hacks and coughs and goes, you know, there's nothing elegant about what I'm doing. I'm just putting down raw power. And I think, I'm hoping that these bikes will be a little bit more like that rather than, you know, the loud but smooth experience of, you know, listening to a 1 liter inline four.
Right.
So.
But again, icon of a generation, wicked fast, lots of torque, super fun.
Wheelie monster.
Best bike of the world.
Totally agree. Okay, moving on to worst bike in the world this week. The Velocet LE. LE stands for little engine. Because, oh my god, it's a little engine. This is probably the smallest displacement we've done so far. So this is a motorcycle from 1949. And it is garbage, even by 1949 standards. And we're going to get into that. So it is a one... Everything about this motorcycle is 50% genius and 50% just the worst decision making you've ever heard of in your life. And it probably leans more towards the worst decision making, hence why it's such a colossal failure. This motorcycle is bizarre. So they wanted a narrow engine. So they made it side valve because it's a flat twin, but they didn't need to make it a flat twin, but they did. It's 4-stroke side valve, flat twin, liquid cooled, which sounds both technologically advanced and living in the past. And even for 1949, it was both of those things. It's shaft drive, which seems cool, but it's also hand start.
Shaft drive is generally a very nice thing to have, and it is a lot of convenience, but shaft drive robs you of a significant amount of power.
And when you're only making 6 horsepower to begin with...
That's a pretty hefty tax.
Right. It's unclear to me what the actual horsepower was, but in 1949, there weren't a whole lot of dynos around, right? So who knows where this, like, 6 horsepower is measured at, crank or wheel, and in what universe it does make a full 6 horsepower. Who knows? But basically, this bike tops out at 30. This attains the kinds of speeds that now you can attain with a 50cc Honda Metropolitan, which has been living on its side in someone's backyard for the last 6 months. Kick it over with some starter fluid and hold that bitch wide open, and you're going just as fast as one of these things. It looks unlike any other motorcycle. The controls are bizarre. So there's a right hand shift, 3-speed suicide gear shift mechanism, which was done for ease of use and to attract, you know, riders that, you know, didn't want to mess up their shoes or something and get a female market into riding. But again, that's dumb because Velocette is known for creating the positive stop gear shift mechanism that is still used in motorcycles today. So why would they abandon their awesome system to go with this other system that might have other benefits? I don't know.
It's such a weird concept that they would think that hand start would be more appealing to women, which must be based on the kind of shoes they would expect them to wear.
Right. And that was the thinking.
But there were plenty of scooters around at this time.
Yeah. Well, those scooters were kickstarts.
Well, maybe, but if you're a woman and you're going to go and work a full-time job and you need transportation and you needed to make a living, would your shoes get in the way of that?
I don't know. I mean, but that's what this was another time.
But I believe they had the technology. Well, this to carry was a time when riding shoes.
Yeah, but this was a time when riding a motorcycle was seen as a very unladylike thing to do. Right. Okay. So there we go. Now we need to talk about the history of Velocette. Well, let's get a little bit more into the specs of this. So this thing's, you know, a bear to operate. The throttle is on the right, but the clutch and the brake are not correct, not where you expect them to be. It's got
I do like the concept of having to hold the clutch with your left hand, operate the shifter with your right hand, and have no hand or foot near a brake.
Yeah, it's bizarre. The that's really something else. It's got, you have to set the timing as you're riding on it. You have to advance the timing manually from a switch on the bike. You know, of course, choke as well and all that sort of stuff. So let's go back in time. It's 1904. A guy named Johann Gutmann moves from Germany with his family to England, or already has moved, and then establishes a company called Veloce, which is weird because that's an Italian word, I believe, which means fast, right? And they want to make cars, but it's not really going to work out for them. They just don't have the resources. They can't get off the ground. They're making all sorts of just weird stuff. This is sort of like the age of invention, right? Where generally handy, sort of engineering-minded people could just sort of invent new shit all the time, right? So they start making some bikes, and they make some really crazy sort of technologically advanced clutches and gear shift mechanisms. They're making these hand-built 2-stroke motorcycles, which are known for a really high hand-built style build quality to them, and they fetch a higher price because of that. And they survive through both wars, and you know, they don't get any big government contracts through those wars either to keep them going. You know, it's not like Royal Enfield that started making rifles and all of that, and then, you know, came out the other end of the war an even bigger company, or Harley Davidson had a similar story, right? Harley Davidson didn't make rifles, but Harley Davidson, I think, did make a bunch of weird shit for the army on top of motorcycles. But, I'm not entirely clear on that, actually. But anyway, they didn't have the normal wartime story that motorcycle companies usually do when you look at these things up. And in 1948, they start looking ahead and like where things are going. And they decide that, kind of looking at scooter companies popping up, the future is in smaller motorcycles and it's in a vehicle for the masses. So Their factory, you know, heavy quotations, was not very large. The assembly line was like 20 feet long. They had like 40 guys working for them, right? And they were making motorcycles at a very slow rate. They never sold more than like 1,000 motorcycles in a year, right? And this company went up to 1971 from 1904, right? So that's a long run, but never really made anything in any large volume to speak of. They put all their eggs in the basket of this weird machine. You know, by this time, the founder changed his name to John Goodman. So we're just going to be talking a lot about John Goodman inventing weird motorcycle shit. And he's an interesting character because he's the head of his family, employs like all his younger siblings in this business, and they're all engineers as well. And as his family effort, they put all their knowledge together to create this weird little bike. And it's a pressed steel square off frame. It's bolted together. It's kind of looks more scooter than it is motorcycle, but you know, engineering wise, it's more motorcycle than it is scooter, but they try to market it as the two wheeled car. And they're trying to be progressive and getting women to ride it, but women don't want to ride it. No one wants it. They have to throw out all their tooling. It's incredibly expensive for them to make this thing. It costs 50% more than its direct competition, the BSA Bantam, and nobody wants it, and it throws them into financial chaos. Until the bike is adopted by the police force. So, who are the police force at this time? It's 1949. They're all late 20s World War II veterans who have done nothing for the last few years but slowly walk across Europe out in the open shooting at people. And they don't like doing that anymore. And this motorcycle has the weird quality of being the quietest motorcycle on the market with a pretty good range of about 100 miles on a tank. And they can fit radios to it. So for this simple reason that they can show up less detected on the scene without having to walk to nab bad guys is a big plus for these battle-hardened badasses that really don't feel like walking around anymore to deal with dangerous people. Now, the problem is that it is successful with the police force. So, Velocet becomes dependent on the sales of this machine to the police.
Which is sort of like becoming super dependent on a minimum wage job.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I can't quit my job at McDonald's because I won't make $400 this week, which I really need that $400, right? Which, you know, there should be some universe in which you can get like an $800 loan and take a few days to fill up job applications in some other place if you really are good at what you do, right? But they never make that point until it's way too late. Like, they make almost exclusively just this motorcycle, except for, like, a few one-off race bikes. They make pretty much just this thing for a decade. And they just lose a lot of what makes the company what it is. They try to update it and do some other, you know, scooter concepts, which are, frankly, really beautiful and awesome. But by then, it's way too late. And those models are then even much more expensive for them to make. And so no one buys them because it's not practical to be able to buy one. You know, at this time, the average English tradesman was making about £4 a week. And this motorcycle cost almost £170. So this is a 150cc that's sort of like a motorcycle that costs 10 grand today. You know, in terms of how much these average workers are making and how much income it takes for them to save up and buy one, right?
Right.
This is a major investment. Whereas the BSA Bantam is like buying a bike for 6 grand, right? So you would always go with the BSA. And that's what people did.
But this is so quiet.
Yeah. Yeah. And the lengths they went to make it quiet are really interesting, because it being quiet and user friendly for women were two of the biggest things that they went for in designing it. It's side valve because they thought, well, the engine can't be too wide, because then it won't allow people to use the foot platforms, you know, so like high heels don't get hung up on, you know, pegs. We need foot platforms, right? It's not kickstart because of people wearing fancy shoes. It's handstart for that reason. And then they lined the inside of the chassis, and it really is a chassis, not a motorcycle frame. It's this Presteel like chassis that is kind of more like a car chassis than a bike frame. They lined that with felt for sound damping or dampening, whatever you want to say, all these things. And so anyway, the bike just cripples the company. And, you know, towards the end, like the mid-60s, they put out what becomes their most notable model in hindsight, the Thruxton, which is a 500cc four-stroke, which is their fastest bike and whatever. And they've been doing race versions of bikes like that. But it was just already too late. They just couldn't get the sales, and they had to close up shop in 1971. So this motorcycle has the distinction of being the first worst bike in the year to actually kill a fucking motorcycle company. And not just anyone, a well-known name, right? If you know anything about old British motorcycles, you've heard of Velocette. Like, you know, even if you don't know what they are and you can't recall a specific model, you've heard of the name Velocette. And this terrible little poorly conceived experiment crippled and broke the company. And it's a microcosm of what did kill the entire British automotive industry, which isn't bad engineering, because the thing wasn't poorly engineered. And it isn't, it's just bad business sense. And it's like, you know, it's not the British industry wasn't trying to look forward, because they were. You know, if you think about this motorcycle and what it is, it's not all that radically different than, say, the Honda Super Cub. And it predates it by like 58, 40, like a good decade, right? But the timing was wrong, and it wasn't quite right, and it was too expensive, and they didn't know when to quit and just cut bait with it, right? So it's a comedy of errors. And when you look deep into what killed every single British motorcycle company, it's this comedy of errors. You know, with Triumph, it's just like, oh, well, let's just keep making the Bonneville bigger and people will buy it. We won't make it more reliable. Well, I guess we'll throw on electric start. But they wouldn't like just stop and make a new bike, right? And a lot like Harley Davidson right now, all these companies would make a lot of bikes by just recombining other parts. They'd make these sort of parts bins bikes, you know, back in the 40s and 50s, they were already doing that. And then, you know, Velocette did at least go through the effort to design a new thing and come up with a concept for a people's bike when they had this reputation for being a high-end boutique product. But it didn't come together right, and they couldn't admit that they were wrong. You know, when they designed this bike, you know, John Goodman was already like getting to be an old man, and he had himself a real nice house in the middle of Birmingham. And he thought, well, everyone's just going to like, you know, get a small little bike to ride around the city and get to work. But this is a time when in the UK, no one had a car. Their way to get across larger distances was motorcycle, because everyone was getting to work on trains and buses. Personal transportation, getting to where you want to go when you want to go, was achieved for most Brits through a motorcycle. So bikes at this time needed to have range, needed to have reliability, and they needed to just be durable and, you know, frankly, like larger CC. And he was out of touch, but he wouldn't admit it, and they wouldn't cut bait. And so it's a comedy of errors. And this motorcycle not only just killed Velocette, it really represents the poor thinking and business sense of the entire British motorcycle scene and why it died. And I can't think of like one single bike that's so much more obvious. Like, whatever you're doing right now, stop and look at a picture of this thing. We've got one linked in the show notes. It looks unlike anything you've ever seen. And there is no way that you personally, even if it was 1949, would ever back this horse. It's crazy looking. It's unsettling to look at. I would rather French kiss Sloth from the Goonies than ride this motorcycle.
I think it looks like a Lego bicycle.
It does have like this kind of, even though it is clearly well put together, the aesthetic around it is sort of like, you know, early, you know, Eastern Bloc communist like automotive design. It's this weird, like, it's this,
it looks like
utilitarian.
It looks like, you remember that show Junkyard Wars?
Yeah.
It looks like a Junkyard Wars team was tasked with building a motorcycle out of car junk parts.
By the way, scrap heap challenge if you're from Canada or England.
Yeah. That was a great show. Whatever happened to that show?
I don't know. It was amazing.
'Cause it's a reality TV show that actually had like substance. Like people actually did build things on there, and it people would explore skills. Yeah, engineering principles. You would learn things about engines and mechanics and welding and whatever. Very slowly, but it did have like real substance. Oh, I miss it.
It was a reality show. You actually had to have some sort of skill or talent to be on.
Yeah, and there was no whining and fighting.
Yeah.
I mean, every once in a while, you could read between the lines and, like, you know, they'd get a close-up shot of the team leader's face and he'd be, like, making some cross look at somebody as they were just really slowly dragging in some part from the yard. But that was as drama as it got.
Occasionally, they'd have, like, a team of like actual shop mechanics, and they slowly became unraveled as they got a little too sober.
You know, I love looking back at these 40s bikes because the technology is kind of limited up to that point, and I almost feel like today you could recreate these bikes yourself, like out of your own garage to an extent. I feel like it wouldn't take a lot to one off this bike.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, casting your own weird 150cc opposed twin side valve, I mean, you could. I guess if you started, yeah, I mean, you could make something very close to this in spirit in your garage. That's true.
I feel like I could bend the metal using techniques that I learned in shop class in high school.
I don't know. I could rig one of I could rig something like this up in my garage, but I would have to just buy a bunch of like existing bike parts and Frankenstein them together. Like, I don't think I'm up to task of just like creating a bespoke shaft drive system. You know, as confident as I am in myself, you know, and I'm not going to trust a 3D printed one either. But no, I get what you're saying. It's not that far away. But again, it's 1940. And again, that's how this bike literally was made, right? This was a handcrafted bike. This wasn't, there was no production line. This is 40 dudes with some machining tools. You know, these guys were like bending metal. These guys were painting and these guys were making, you know, this bike from whole cloth. And it's weird because when you look at every other Velocet, it's just a piece of rolling art. And then there's this, you know? Because this era, like the late 40s, right? You've got, you know, Bullet 500s are coming around. you know, Norton, BSA, Triumph, they're all going strong with these really just wonderful swoopy designs. And everything's got not everything's sort of just gotten past that point of just a bicycle and a tank and a motor strap to it. And it's they've all become real motorcycles, and they've started incorporating art into the aesthetic of all of them. You know, the Brough Superior is around at this time, right? I mean, this is around the time T. Lawrence killed himself on one. What year did T. Lawrence die? 50, 51?
I have no idea.
Look it up. Do my bidding, Swiggy. But this is around that time, though. Like, we're within a few years. I don't know if it's before or after, but it's close to that time, you know? And every other bike on the market is just gorgeous. And then there's this, oh, right?
But you're way off.
Yeah, am I?
35.
He died before World War II?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I thought he at least made it through World War II. He died in between the wars. Okay, so yeah, this is after T. Lawrence bid it on a Brough Superior, right? It's not like there weren't, like, 1 liter bikes capable of 100 miles per hour at this time. That, you know, that were four stroke. That, you know, the Vincent Black Shadow was out at this time. The Vincent Black Shadow had this crazy front suspension system that worked like a lot better than you'd think. The rear suspension on a Vincent Black Shadow is just like the rear suspension on my Super Hawk. The swing arm is attached to the back of the engine casing of the V-twin, and then a monoshock underneath it. Like, it's crazy technologically advanced for the time. Like, people don't really think about how old all these concepts are and how long they've been around. And then there's just, here comes the LE with its side valve 150cc motor and a stamped steel frame when everything else is like tubular steel and double cradle, and we've got monoshocks going on, and there's disc brakes. You know, I believe the Vincent Black Shadow was disc brake. It was cable operated, I think. They might have had drums. I'm not sure. But there were bikes around at this time that even had disc brakes. Again, cable operated, which isn't really that much better than drums. But disc brakes, and like this, the things were around. But then there's this thing that just makes you have to advance the timing yourself as you're riding it, and they're like, everyone's gonna love it, right? And then no one did
part. Advance the timing yourself.
Yes. Yeah, it, like, you have to adjust the choke and the timing to get it started, and then adjust them to keep it running.
So, like, when you're warming it up, not like through operation.
So when you get into a higher RPM,
seems like kind of a big deal.
Yeah, it is. You didn't. Yeah, it is. It's nuts, right? So, like, you know, your timing would, you know, normally run off your camshaft, right? You have these points that go, and but this was a different mechanical, like, this was a different, like, mechanism that you had to set the timing on yourself. It wouldn't just run off the cam
because it was side valve.
Right, it was side us. There is no cam to run it off of. Exactly, everything about this bike is like in their concept to create a vehicle for everyone. They were genius, but the way they executed it was fucking bananas.
So they wanted to have the kind of the front little fairing bit and have the platforms, and in order to fit the engine in, they then went with side valve. Which then meant they didn't have cams, which means the rider then had to advance the timing. If you had to choose between changing your shoes and having to advance the timing manually and have a suicide shift, which would you go for?
Now, there's an important thing about this bike we have not talked about, which is what the bike was actually known as to the people. And this is really telling. It was known as the Naughty Bike because the police constables that rode it were known as Naughties, because they were normally required to salute every time they met a superior officer. However, this bike was so crazy to operate, they argued and won that it was flat out dangerous to remove their hands from the controls for even a moment to just salute. So instead, they were allowed to simply nod at superior officers, therefore becoming known as Noddies, and this was the Noddy bike by extension. The whole bike got its name because it's just straight up difficult and dangerous to operate, and you cannot remove your hands from the controls for even a brief moment.
So I'm having this flashback to your dad. Like, the third motorcycle that I ever rode in my life was, I'd ridden like your old Nighthawk. I had my Kawasaki, my KZ,
mm-hmm.
and I used your dad's, like, I was climbing on your dad's Ducati.
Right.
And I wasn't sure, like, well, were the controls different on this thing? And he said, no. The bike controls have not changed in 60 years. This goes slightly further back from that, when it was kind of more of
it was
Wild West.
Yes, it was lawless. I mean, it did follow some conventions in that at this time, there was a loose standard in British bikes that the gear selector was on your right foot instead of left, and your gear changes were made opposite. So you would click up to shift down and down to shift up. So it was sort of a right-hand foot version of what people here call GP shift now. And then, yeah, your rear brake on the other foot, on the other side. And clutch, throttle, and front brake where they are now. Those are normal. So this does follow that convention, except it removed the gear selector from your foot to your hand. But your right hand was still responsible for throttle as well and front brake. So, yeah, I guess when you were changing gear, you did have access to the rear brake with your left foot on this motorcycle thing. But you didn't have any access to throttle. But throttle's pretty important to changing gears on a motorcycle. So, yeah. The whole thing's insane. If you watch a YouTube video of some, like, old guy explaining how to work it and ride it, I mean, well, first of all, it's just a whole bunch of dudes from the Midlands, like, talking in a really unsatisfying British accent about, you know, things you don't understand and don't care to. And I watched a lot of YouTube videos of just old guys talking about the good old days of motorcycling in Britain, reading up on this thing. But, you know, and there were a lot of, like, BBC, like, 2 reports of, you know, like, and Velocette moves on to the motorcycle of the future. Britain marches forth with the 2-wheeled car and things like that. And it's, I don't know. I understand where they were going, but their refusal to quit and just the complete backwardsness of this motorcycle and it being shitty even for 1949 standards is a new low bar. Like, how can you be a shitty motorcycle? I can't believe I'm saying this. I would rather ride a Bullet 500 any distance than this thing. I mean, I am, like, automatically, because this bike is so unusual looking and probably so awful, I am kind of slightly endeared to it, but in its context and history, it is a pockmark on the face of motorcycles, and we would all have been better off without it. We might still have Velocette today. Mm-hmm. And who knows what sort of awesome things they might have done, right? There's plenty of weird small boutique companies like Bimoda or whatever who are still around, you know? All right, come on. But nope. Instead, we got robbed. And I'm just getting really depressed now, just thinking more about the whole collapse and implosion of British bikes. Let's put a little break in here and then move on to something else. Boom, 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 boom. Okay, and we're rolling again. So now we're going to play a game. Not a new game. A game we've played before. All right, guys and gals, the new sensation that's sweeping the nation. It's time to play. What would that be? Okay, so this is the game where we all come up with a category of names. Then we reveal them to each other. And then on the spot, we have to determine what that bike would be. Okay, so, and let's go around and everyone reveal their categories. Let's start with you, Swiggy.
My category today is period architecture.
Okay. All right. Mine is gambling.
Ooh.
Nice.
What have you got, Mike?
I've got place names.
Place names. All right. Solid all around. Okay. So I think we're going to go with the format that we went for on our first pass of this episode. And one person will announce, and then the other two can sort of tag team come up with what the name will be. So, much like whose line is it anyway, it's none of the points matter. So, you want to start with one, Swiggy?
Yep. First bike is the Victorian.
The Victorian. Jeez. Okay. All right. I've got it. So, in this age where everyone's doing retro bikes and everything, there's a few small companies that are doing like ultra retro bikes, like Janus, right? With those like 150 sort of, you know, things like their Halcyon and whatever. This is going to be something like that. This is going to be something like that, but it's going to be made by a major manufacturer. Even better. Okay, so also everyone's bringing back old bike names too, right? So while there weren't really any motorcycles in the Victorian era, someone is going to bring back the Velocette name. Who would be the one to buy that and bring it back? Whoever has just bought and brought back the Norton name, they're going to do that with a company like Velocette, if not Velocette. And they're going to create this ultra retro bike, the Victorian, and it's going to be something that like you might actually have to set the timing on yourself and everything. It's going to be that throwback, right? It's going to have something like a 35cc two stroke on it. It's going to be, you know, like a bicycle frame, but it's, you know, with an engine on it, but it's going to go for that full on look with the square gas tank mounted on top of the crossbar on top of the bicycle frame. It's going to go for all that. It's going to go for the really long pullback handlebars, right? But going to that like Victorian thing, it's going to be extremely ornate. There's going to be like gold leaf, you know, put into the frame all over. It's going to be very deco. And all of that. And it's going to cost something outrageous like $63,000 for this 35cc two-stroke called the Victorian.
You know, Peter, for all your insight, you seem to act like you have never appreciated the wonderful Will Smith movie that is The Wild West.
The Wild West. Jim West, Desperado, you want some? No, you don't want nada? Excuse me, I've never appreciated the genius of this film.
So this bike, it is everything that you say it is, but it is the first mass-produced steampunk vehicle.
Holy shit, you're right. This is so throwback. It's steam powered. Mm. Oh my God, you're right. Oh my gosh. Okay, so it can't be under like an old mark. This has got to be some like super pretentious one-off build by, not a one-off build, but like, you know, they make like 35 bikes a year, sort of like Janus, right? But they're going to be making production steam-powered bikes, which will be no problem for emissions, right?
I don't know where you get your water. I think coal has a pretty high particulate count.
I get, yeah, but there's a filter you can put on. There's a way to do that pretty simply.
It's
not going to be cost effective, but it is simple.
My thinking was that it was going to be sort of like a ridiculously large but low horsepower single, like a 750cc single, making something like 28 horsepower.
Okay.
And then you would like wrap the exhaust as like a 1-2 exhaust wrapped like all around the bike, and maybe even have some fake piping all around it, just like all brass coated, and make it look really busy and very steampunk.
Okay. I think you're right in the aesthetics of it, but Mike is completely correct that this is the last word in hipster. Like it's an actual production steampunk bike, and it's gonna be so hipster it just makes the whole hipster motorcycle world just implode.
And
there's nowhere to go from there. It's peak hipster.
Like, if it were a dual clutch and it had a parking brake, the parking brake would be kind of like the Velocet shifter, but it would be visible all the way down the bike. It would be 3 feet long, and it would have, like, a little clamp on the end, kind of like...
A release.
Yeah.
Catch release, yeah.
Like you were changing tracks on a railway switch.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. There'd be a little lion head at the top of the handle.
Yeah.
You could theoretically shift down in gears in this thing and haul a train with it at very low rev.
Okay.
It may hit 3,000 RPM.
Maybe. Well, yeah, well, it's steam, so I don't really know what the average RPM is on steam, but I think it's very low.
I don't think you could actually make it steam. I think the mechanics of steam require a certain minimum economy of scale to be productive, but...
There were production steam bikes, and people do rig them up from time to time. Like it is doable on a motorcycle.
You can make tabletop steam engines.
Yeah, no, it's totally doable.
I have no idea how powerful they are, but you can get like there are tiny handheld steam engines
that are actually have like the coal burning on them. Oh,
yeah, I don't know about now, that. With the coal burning on them, the problem with these bikes is you might think it's a real big pain in the ass to sit around and wait for your engine to heat up on a carbureted bike. On a steam-powered bike, you've got to sit there for like 25, 45 minutes in your driveway waiting for this to boil up and create pressure for you to then release. And then you think electric vehicles have a short range. These have a range of like 20 miles at best. There's no stopping. You have to use it all at once.
Is this going to be like when the hipsters of today are in their 50s and 60s, this becomes like a sort of boutique racing phenomena?
Possibly. But I think we've nailed it. All right. So we'll move on to one of mine. Okay. So gambling terms, guys. All right. Here we go. I'm going to throw you an easy one at first. Gambling terms, just gambling in general. So this isn't so much a gambling term, but this is gambling related. The Triple Crown.
The Triple Crown. Okay, so this is going to be a high-performance three-cylinder motorcycle. It's not going to be a production bike. It's going to be, like a boutique version of a street triple, okay, where it's going to have everything stripped off it, the subframe and and like the swing arm are going to be replaced with carbon fiber, and it's going to be as slim down as possible. And I'm just trying to think what really makes it the Triple Crown. This is hard.
It's a racing custom. It's for MotoGP.
It's a super high-end custom flat tracker. Three-cylinder made out of a street trip.
Okay, you're close. I didn't really think about this one before, but I know now what this is. So the same pretentious dickheads that made the Ronin are going to buy a bunch of street triples, and they're going to put the same weird front suspension on them, and they're going to make a limited run out of them using only the names of Triple Crown winning horses for each individual bike.
Okay. I feel like the flat tracking aspect of it is important.
They might do them as flat trackers, but the same concept applies, right? All right, so let's move on to my...
We should get those guys as guests on your show.
Yeah, right. We said so many complimentary things.
They're local. I mean, it was here and it was in Denver.
Yeah, that's true. Shop was. All right, Mike, hit us with one.
All right, so place names. My first one for you gentlemen. I'll start simple as well. Hokkaido.
Hokkaido.
Hmm.
If this was a snowmobile, this would be so easy. Okay. Hokkaido.
Hmm. Okay. I'm thinking dirt bike.
Okay. So, Hokkaido, being the northern island of Japan, is known for being a bit arctic. It's known for skiing, and it's known for unusual monkeys. I think what they're going to do is create...
Are these Honda, like the hot spring monkeys?
Honda's going to bring back the monkey bike.
Okay.
And there's not gonna be that much special about it, except it'll be painted all white with this blue seat, and it's gonna be made available with ice racing tires.
Okay.
All right.
Oh, so like the front wheel, the front mudguard is going to be raised up a bit, and it'll have OEM
like spike tires
for it.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not a tracker or anything. It gets around the problem with being like a mini ice bike.
So instead of having a front fender, it has more of a cage.
No, there's no cage. In fact, there may not even really be much of a front fender at all. It's just, it's like, you know, like cleats. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if you've ever seen like ice racing tires. Yeah.
Nails and stuff. Screws.
Well, yeah, they're more like spikes in the bottom of a cleat, though, that come out of the tire. Like a shit ton of them. Like 1,000 of them in one tire or some crap like that. So it'll just have these ridiculously expensive... special tires that you have to buy for it. It's just a mini monkey bike, but it's for riding in the snow because it's an ice bike with ice tires.
That's good. The Hokkaido. Yeah, sure.
All right. Okay. So we'll get hit with another one quick.
All right. The next one is Mediterranean.
The Mediterranean. The Mediterranean is going to be a scooter like the Honda Metropolitan, right? Except it's going to be sort of the styling's going to change. Right. So rather going for this classic Vespa look, or rather going for this like Aprilia modern racing scooter look, it's going to go for this sort of like new age, like EDM kids sort of aesthetic. It's going to have a lot of glowing lights and things like that. And its big feature is going to be like glove box storage. So you have a lot of places to like put your weed, put your E, all that kind of crap, right? So it's going to have like glove boxes within glove boxes, right? So if like a cop pulled you over, he just can't even be bothered to go through everything on your bike to find the illegal drugs.
Okay.
Each one comes with its own secret compartment.
They'll just have weird little mini storage spots all over the thing.
Oh. The ultimate smuggler's bike.
Yeah, but for just like only enough drugs for like two nights of partying. Right?
All right.
Okay.
Yeah, I was going to say a Metropolitan, just like a white or sand-colored Metropolitan, but it comes with its own beach umbrella. And that is just going to be the extent of my answer.
Oh, so
I like yours much like better.
Beach umbrella and Orzo.
So instead of just like the little like half-foot-long like umbrellas that like completely fold out, it's one of those, but it's a full-on like beach parasol.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what? I like that better. Okay, so you know how, like, I'm changing my... forget everything I said. No, I've got it. So the Mediterranean, it's still, it's a 50cc scooter, right? Very Vespa or Honda Metropolitan traditional scooter looking, right? So it's going to have the engine mounted over one wheel well, but the other side of it has, it just comes with this big, like, collapsible, super collapsible beach umbrella that unfolds surprisingly large, and towels and all that other stuff. It just comes with a beach kit built into the other side of it. Now, of course, everyone will buy them, throw that stuff away, and just use it for whatever.
Storing their weed,
exactly. It will become sort of the vision that I laid out before, but it'll just be marketed as this beach-going sort of Mediterranean surf vehicle. And to really drive it home, they will put some, like, fake wood paneling sort of things on it to sort of, like, hint at this American beach lifestyle. But, of course, it won't be sold in the U.S. So it'll be for Mediterranean, you know, Italian teenagers to sort of live out this American beach dream on their scooter.
There's one feature you missed.
What's that?
It will come with a kit to hold a surfboard.
Yeah, it will. It will. Okay.
Necessary.
Well, no, this is the Mediterranean, so it'll be a windsurfer. But yeah. Okay. All right, now I got one for you. The poker.
The poker. Hmm. Huh. Okay, so this bike is not going to show you. This bike is not going to tell you exactly what it is. It's going to have a lot under wraps. So this bike, okay, so this bike is going to be, there's going to be multiple versions of this bike. And it's going to have a large, ridiculous fairing on it. And the fairing is almost going to be like come way over it down into a point, like a cow catcher on the front of a train.
Okay.
And it's going to have lots of like internal hidden storage, like within the fairing. It's going to come in a one cylinder, a two cylinder, and a four cylinder version.
Okay.
And the fairing on different models may or may not be removable. And allow you to carry things like the fairing's going to be so large, you're going to be able to carry spare tires inside the fairing. And it will come with adjustable suspension, and you may or may not be able to fast change out the wheels and be able to take it off-road. But it might not be able to. You may not have equipped it that way.
Okay.
This is the kind of bike that you have to order, and it will arrive at your house before you find out what model number you ordered.
So I'm thinking something really similar. I think you're close, Woogie. I think it's a bike that has, yeah, probably a very unique fairing or whatever. But I think what it is, and I think you got really close with the different engine options. I think the front fairing, your engine choice, your storage choice, your seat choice, and your suspension choice will all be, you'll all, you know, be able to pick of a few different styles. So this is a bike that you'll be able to order in all these different permutations, right? So your bike will sort of be like the draw of a hand of these five different aspects. Mm. And you'll be able to sort of piece them together in the flavors that you like of the different options for these, right? So it'll be like a king and queen riser and a flat seat, and there'll be a sport seat and whatever, and there'll be, you know, one single box at the back or no luggage or two side bags or a leather bag or whatever. And the only way you build this out, you know, isn't with things like heated grips and all those other weird little ticky-tacky tiny things that you go through when you build a bike off of.
You're really picking fundamental aspects.
You're picking these five fundamental aspects of it with, you know, the choice of like four different flavors. Ooh, oh, okay. Yeah. And then so like touring, sports, adventure, and off-road are all the different suits, right, that you're choosing from. Right, for each of the aspects. And so you sort of draw your five options from these four suits, and then that is the bike at the end.
That's pretty cool.
Is this going to be the world's first truly modular bike?
I think so.
That's good. You could go on a good poker run with this bike.
Maybe.
Okay. No, but actually, I think you're both wrong on this name.
Okay.
Because you're overlooking a market that was very much present in the US that is now not being addressed. And that is with the exit of Victory.
Right.
All of those models, I mean, those were those were basically an attempt to brand and capitalize on the chopper. And in fact, they gave them Vegas names. There's the Victory Vegas.
Yeah, the eight ball.
And And so this is going to be, the poker is going to be the Polaris poker, or the Indian poker, and it's going to be an attempt to recapture what Polaris bought and actually use it for what it was already doing.
Okay, so rather than try to disguise the Victory bikes as Indians, they're just going to put out a bike maybe under the Indian name that is just straight up an old Victory model, like the Vegas that was really popular, and just call it the Poker, because just for their own shame, they have to come up with a different name for it.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's way more probable than what I thought.
I like both of yours much more than my own.
All right, so you give us one.
Yeah, it's mine.
It is Mike.
All right. The Los Alamos.
The Los Alamos.
Okay, so the Los Alamos is not going to be a production bike. It's going to be some mad scientist who has finally unlocked the secret of creating nuclear-powered batteries. Will invent a constant charge, like, nuclear-powered motorcycle with very sketchy with very sketchy lead lining and containment for the radioactive source.
Don't let the coolant run out on this.
And he's rigged it up, and it's somewhat safe. You wouldn't want to be driving behind him. And what he's done is he's built this whole system out of an old Honda PC-800 to be able to conceal all of the mad science under the body.
So it'll look like a totally normal PC-800, except for the weird, strange green light emitting
from you would be forgetting. It. You would be forgiven for thinking that he had installed underglow on his PC-800.
He has to wear his lab coat while he's riding it.
And nobody will really know about this bike until he crashes it while riding it cross country
in his hazmat suit
as he falls off the bike and crashes it due to
radiation sickness.
Yeah, due to radiation sickness. And he'll be found alongside the side of the road, and the story will unravel through the post-mortem analysis of this accident.
Nailed it, sweetie. Nailed it.
I was expecting you to do some kind of a failed attempt at capturing like Americana, like some bobber, but this is better.
You know, I think the PC 800 very much was a failed attempt to capture Americana. All right. So now it's you, Swiggy, right?
Yep.
Okay, here we go.
All right. This one should be a bit easier.
Hit us.
The Gothic.
The Gothic. Okay. So you know how Gibson Guitars was producing super budget Les Pauls and SGs, and they called them like the Les Paul Gothic and the SG Gothic. And all they did was take an SG or, you know, one of their guitars and spec it down as low as they could. And to hide that fact, they gave it just really cheap, you know, goth kid inlay on the fretboards and then painted it matte black to cover up the complete lack of features on this, right? Well, a lot of bike manufacturers have been going for this strategy as well, like the V7 Stone, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the Gothic is going to be this sort of Chinese knockoff of the V7 Stone, but just really specced down, right? Okay. And it won't even be like the transfer. It'll be trying to rip off a Moto Guzzi V7, but it won't even have the transverse V-twin, right? It's going to be a parallel twin because they can't pull off the engineering to make a proper transverse V-twin, right? And the tank is going to be like 98% the same as a Guzzi, right? But, you know, made of cheap metals and all that shit. And everything about it is going to be just so horrible. It's going to come in at like $3,800, right? And it won't be 700 cc's. It'll be like a 400 twin, maybe, right? It's going to make like 20 horsepower at best. But it's going to be as large as a V7, right? So it's gonna be made by it'll be a little bit better than that because Hyosung, the Korean company, Hyosung's gonna make it, and it's gonna be Hyosung's venture into like middleweight naked bikes or whatever, right? But it's still going to be a ripoff of the V7 Stone, but it's going to be called the whatever crazy alphanumeric designation Gothic.
And it'll be such an entry-level bike pricing that this will be a future generation's first bike that they got into when the used Ninja was all that they were probably going to be able to grab at when they were, you know, when they were first looking, scrounging money together. They get one of these, and these are really sketchy kids getting into motorcycles.
Possibly.
Like this thing looks like a cleaned up, simplified version of the Bat Bike.
Well, the problem is because it's going to be like rushed to market, and because it's like painted, so with this cheap paint, it's all about cost saving. There's going to be like weird attributes to this bike where it's going to be obvious that it was painted with the tank actually on the bike. So there's like overspray going from the tank, like onto the wiring harness exposed underneath it. And it's going to come to the point where everyone has realized that Matt Black has finally gone way too far.
Nailed it.
There we go.
I like it.
All right. So that were to me, right? All right. So here's my last one. All right. This is a great gambling term. The parlay.
The parlay. Okay. So this is going to be a dual sport.
Okay.
And it's going to be a rare V-twin. No, not a V-twin. A box twin dual sport that BMW is going to make. And the advantage of it is that it's going to be a little bit faster, but have a little bit less torque. And it's going to have a ridiculously small fuel tank. And the whole point of this bike is basically going to be able to do, it's going to be more street than off-road, and it's really more of like a sprint bike, and it's become really popular, and it's going to popularize dirt bike drag racing.
Okay.
But no, it's gonna be not just drag racing, but it's gonna be like a little sprint bike, and I'm really close on this. Hang on. It's gonna bring back like the old like beach races of like the early, you know, like the 30s
okay.
and 40s.
Yeah,
where
yeah.
it was like, all right, go down the beach.
Go around the cone, come back. Yeah,
go around Butch's girlfriend who's standing and then circle back over here and cross the line. It's gonna be that kind of like dual sport.
Okay, I think we're in agreement on the whole dual sport sort of aspect to it, but I was just sort of thinking quietly to myself that this is going to be the bike that breaks sidecars into the off-road world.
Okay.
And that's pretty half-baked, and I really haven't thought this through any further than that. Well, that is the nature of this game.
There is sidecar racing, so you can have sidecar...
Sidecar motocross.
Yeah. Okay. That's going to bring a whole new aspect to it. Like, you're going to have... You're going to actually have your sidecar racer, like, jumping up and down and using his weight to modulate the suspension just to make it all work.
I love it. Okay, yes. Sidecar motocross. 100%. So,
you're welcome.
But the sidecar, you know, because it's for racing purposes, you know, if you look at the Isle of Man sidecars, right? They're not really sidecars like you're familiar with sidecars, right? They look like a disused piece of playground equipment that someone was sued out of existence for making, right? And so this is going to be even more ridiculous. This motocross sidecar is simply going to be some sort of flexing piece coming out of the middle of the frame of the bike, right? And then joining to a T-bar, which then has just a small, like, platform barely large enough to put both your feet on, and one wheel underneath that, right? Like, it's just going to be this thing to hang on to, and that's it. I mean, you'll be so, the rider will be sort of like crouched over it. It'll lean forwards a little bit, but there's going to be no car to speak of. There's going to be nothing to kneel down into. There's going to be no fairing or crash anything in front of you. Just simply this platform with a single wheel and this T-bar that someone's just white knuckle gripping for dear life. And yeah, I'm with you. Like, this is like immense skill to it, because as you're like cresting the hill and like getting airborne, all of a sudden the weight's going to become unclear as it takes off, right? So these bikes probably will never get more than a few inches off the ground. But again, they've got to land the bike, right? And the rider's got to like straighten the whole thing up. And the passenger is going to just hold the fuck on.
I think the passenger would actually have to have, like, a hand-operated brake for the outside wheel. Because one of the things about motocross is, like, when they're going through the air...
Because they won't be able to put their right leg out. Yeah.
Well, there's that. But also, when, like, motocross bikes are going through the air... they actually use the brake and throttle to spin up and slow down the rear wheel to tip the bike in the air.
Yeah, do it just like the gyroscopic effect. Yeah. So
the sidecar passenger is going to need his own brake on the outside wheel to operate that as well, just to keep the whole thing balanced.
I love this. We need to create motocross sidecar racing. I would so watch that. All right. We may not top that. What have you got, Mike?
All right, last one. The Madagascar.
The Madagascar. Okay.
This is a trials bike. This is a trials bike that is... designed for it for basically all terrain, specifically for being able to fit through narrow paths off road. It's going to come with basically crash bars that allow you to prop it up against trees and like just navigate like over logs and things in very tight conditions. And what else is it gonna
have? So you're talking about something like light enough that you can like do the wheelie hop from one rock to another.
But I think it needs to be is sort of a trials bike blown up. So it's a weird like sort of trials adventure, trials tourer, if that makes any sense. So it's gonna sort of look like a trials bike, except it will have a seat. But it's going to be blown up, like, bigger, right?
So kind of like in the same way that technically a BMX bike is usable transportation, but in practicality, it's really not ideal.
Yeah. I mean, so, yeah, because you know, you'll need to go, because if you in, like, a place like Madagascar or Sri Lanka or, you know, wherever, right? You know, if you're in, like, Rangoon, right? You want this bike to just go like 30 miles, right? And you may need to bring medical supplies or ammunition or something with you, right? That you wouldn't be able to do on a trials bike. But you need trials bike like agility in order to get there, right? And then the Madagascar name comes from the fact that it's still like a two-stroke with drum brakes, because like Madagascar, its genetics like split off from those of the mainland a long time ago, and it's continued along its own evolutionary path. Right? It's like four strokes never entered the equation in this thing's like, you know, evolutionary history. It diverged. It diverged from, you know, British motorcycle culture before World War One, and just, you know, it just ended up on a landmass that floated out to sea, and it's just been doing its own thing ever since. Which is a great analogy, because Trials Bike started in Britain, right? So this is like if you took an old, you know, like an old, you know, like Bullet 500, right? Well, no, because that was four stroke. So take a BSA two stroke, a Bantam or something that, you know, was used as a trials bike, but then just like set it out in the jungle and made it inbreed with itself. You know, a lot inbreed with itself, that's redundant. But if you took a BSA Bantam in the jungle and just had it inbreeding a lot, it would turn into this like trials adventure two stroke.
Okay. I'm just thinking
medical supplies or ammunition.
I feel like it's gonna have some really useful, like, adaptive solutions. Like, instead of just having a clamp for handlebars in case you like bent them dropping the bike and you're in the middle of nowhere, it'll come with like straps, so if you need to, you could just like chop a branch off a tree and then just like strap it across the handlebars and you'd be able to keep going. And soldier on.
Or the wheels, like the spokes, have these little wood platforms that you can pop out from the remote control to, like, when you're on sort of sketchy, swampy terrain, they can just pop out and give you a little extra support. Like, so you can roll over a bunch of, like,
I've got
sticks.
I've got it. In the event that your tires, you get a flat tire and then you're in the middle of nowhere,
mm-hmm.
It has a normally deflated inner tube, and if you get a flat tire and you need to keep going, you can just fill it with water to fill it back up.
Whoa.
And that's your spare. You can just fill it with seawater.
Oh my god. Keep going. Yeah, there we go. All right, yeah, we've got to stop there. The Madagascar is just too weird.
Okay, we have to be patenting these.
Breaking these ideas. Yeah, can Honda hire us? Maybe. Okay, so we're going to talk about some motorcycle news items real quick. Everyone's been talking about this for a couple weeks, but I really want to give our take on Ford's weird minivan with a scooter inside patent thing. All right, so we've all taken a look at this, and we've got an interesting take, or Swiggy, you have an interesting take on this that I think everyone wants to hear.
Okay, so, you know, as electric cars draw near, and when you look at, like, the new Euro regulation, emissions regulations, and the, and things like the, you know, in Japan, you know, they have the Japanese domestic market, which also often has, lots of cars that are really desirable over here, but are quite expensive because of the displacement tax they have. You know, there's all sorts of reasons why you can't really build the kind of street performance you would like because you're restricted by emissions and all sorts of regulations. My theory...
Well, and power-to-weight ratio.
Power-to-weight ratio and all that stuff. So my theory is that much like how some... You know, how we built the SUV because now it's no longer a car.
Right, it's a truck.
It's a truck, so you get to have truck emission standards. This is taking that to its logical conclusion. And now they're going to build a motorcycle with car emission standards.
Well, okay. Well, I don't think it's car emission standards, because I think bikes are held to a looser standard than you know, regular four-wheel vehicles are pretty much everywhere, right?
Well, except for power-to-weight ratio.
Exactly. That's where I think it's going to come in. So Ford will sell this behemoth motorcycle in Japan and Europe that people with just regular driver's licenses will then be able to operate this, like, 1 liter or 800cc, you know, fucking fast, big, powerful bike. And they'll legally be allowed to sell it because technically the whole package is a car.
That's what I think.
And I think this is absolutely dead on. I think Ford is... well, and Ford's not going to make it. Ford is going to charge someone like Yamaha a boatload to do it. Right? Because, you know, like Ford owned the VMAX technology that Yamaha used for that bike, right? And this has happened many, many times. I think Ford just beat everyone to the punch. And someone's going to come up with some sort of design similar enough to this, where it's going to have four wheels technically or whatever it is. But this vehicle, it's going to be a motorcycle hidden inside something else, right? It's not going to be a minivan. It's not going to be a Ford. You know, it's not going to... the people in, you know, Spain aren't going to start buying Windstars so they can ride 800cc motorcycles, right? That's, you know, not what's going to happen. You know,
they show a minivan in the pictures on the patent, but the place this really actually makes a lot of sense would be like an electric bike with like a smart car sized car. Where the wheelbase is basically going to be identical.
Yeah, so when we were hashing this out yesterday, my whole approach to it was maybe this, like, we kept using the word van, but maybe it's a very scaled down vehicle that you can just take, like, open up your small hatch, literally remove the engine from it, and just keep going with most of the remaining weight sitting behind you.
Or, if it's an electric bike, you would mainly be driving it around as a car, and the usefulness there is that the primary purpose of the car chassis is that, with all the extra volume, you're mainly using it to cart around extra battery capacity. And you get a cabin and some storage out of it as well.
See, my theory to this is that it's never going to see the light of day. That it's more a patent trick where they got a bunch of brainstorming together, and then they probably got on the internet and looked at how people were trying to solve energy problems, and they figured out that this theme of a vehicle in another vehicle was this thing that kept popping up. So they went as broad as possible so that they could under-patent any great ideas that come out in the future.
Yeah, that's what I was getting
at. And so they could torpedo their partner, or they could torpedo the competition because they own this base patent.
Right. Yeah, and I said yesterday, I thought, like, you know, someone from Ford is buddies with someone at Honda or whoever, and they got word around the water cooler that someone was thinking of something like this. So they just rushed out to do this very vague, all-encompassing patent idea. So when someone does try to do it, Ford can go, we need our cut.
Yeah.
Or just plain stop them from doing it.
So I think that's the most likely scenario. But I'm still trying to, like,
but I do agree that someone's trying to do it so they can sell a faster, bigger motorcycle to a market that wants it. Very easily by putting a vehicle inside a vehicle.
I'm sure there'll be some weird, you know, country like Eastern European country or somewhere where this will totally fit within the laws that you'll just be able to drive it on your regular driver's license without exactly. any kind of endorsement.
Okay. Yeah. I think we got to the bottom of that one pretty quickly. So the only other interesting news item that's come up is Suzuki renewing the Katana name, right? Mm-hmm. So this is interesting. We were talking about how the Suzuki lineup has a big problem with its names. And maybe the reason they've done this isn't that they're thinking of making a new Katana. They just need to start naming some shit in their lineup Katana, because there's a whole lot of everything that starts with GSX.
Well, approximately 80% of their lineup begins with GSX and then has S, R, F, and some combination of 250, 600, 750, or 1000. And
yeah, it's kind of every confusing webpage.
Every permutation of that is their entire lineup. And, you know, all the bikes match up with all the other, with the other big three. And
big four.
Well, they are one of the big four. The other three of the big four.
There you go. Yeah.
Where they have, you know, a race spec bike for each class. And then they have kind of the equivalent street version. And then they also have kind of the detuned version and the budget version of each of those bikes. But yeah, like, I mean, I assure you that both of you have seen plenty of GSXE 750s and 600s on the street. Mm. But nobody would ever tell you that, oh no, it's not a Gixxer, it's not a GSXR, it's the GSXE, which is a little more torque, a little less horsepower. It's got
the GSXS.
Or the S, sorry. Yeah. The S. And then, you know, it's like, well, it's a little more torque, it's significantly less horsepower, it's a bit cheaper, it's got a better riding position for the street, and it's just, it's a Gixxer, you know? Like, you can only have that conversation so many times before you just get sick of it.
Yeah, they need some names. Like, in the sport category, they had the Hayabusa and 9 other alphanumeric titles. And then down below, I'm not sure what category was that below the cruisers, because those had names.
Well, they're all the Boulevard.
Yeah, the Boulevard. And down below the Boulevards, there was a Baker's Dozen. There was another 13 items that none of them had a name. And
yeah.
And it was just too much. So
all the DRs.
So the brand recognition of Katana is just so strong that they're probably going to name the GSXS.
Yeah.
Katana.
That's a smart move, although I said what I really think they need to do is, again, kill the Hayabusa, let it become one with the Force, and a greater legend than we could all possibly imagine, reinvent it as the Hanzo, and then make the not bi-turbo version the Katana. But that still leaves them with their naming problem and the rest of their bikes. But, I mean, you know, you're like, yeah, it looks like just a whole bunch of Gixxers, but you know what? It is just a whole bunch of Gixxers. Is there really a huge problem with calling them that? You know, they've gotten by so far. I don't know.
Swiggy suggested the Shuriken.
Oh, for the 250? Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. The Shuriken. Yeah, they could do that. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. We're at 2 hours now, guys. And I've got to edit all of this. And I hate to be that guy on the podcast that talks about how much they've got to edit this, but I really do have to edit all this crap. So let's see. Do we have anything else for this episode? Anything else anyone wants to bring up?
I think we're good there.
I think we're good, too. All right, so we're going to sign out on this one and roll the outro. Remember, you can email us at nokomotopodcast@gmail.com. I'm MotoGP for Swiggy and Dr. Mike Action. Please leave us ratings and reviews on iTunes. Helps out a bunch. And stay safe and stay tuned.
And I don't want to die, just want to ride on my motorcycle. Mm-hmm. pickle.